when you look at those products and you look at how long people live in them and how much of a rent increase they sustain, in rent increases that they can sustain over time, easily beats multifamily.
Welcome to The Apartment Guys, where we dive deep into all things multifamily investing. Our mission is to educate, inspire, and empower real estate investors to reach their highest potential. Each week, host Tate Seymour interviews high-level guests from all over the industry who are sure to bring valuable, actionable ideas that will propel your career to the next level. Whether you're just starting out or a seasoned investor, you are in the right place. And now your host, the apartment guy, Tate Seymour.
Welcome, everybody, back to another episode of The Apartment Guys. And wow, this is an amazing one. We are welcoming back the mad scientist of multifamily himself, Neil Bawa, to the show. Neil, you were one of our very first guests on the show, I think.
That's right. It was a while back. Yeah.
It was like episode 4 or 5, I think, that you were one of our guests. And so much has changed since then. That was in the fall of 2019. So needless to say, we've gone through so much since then and some great things to talk about. But first of all, I just want to express my gratitude to you for coming back on the show and being such a great friend of the show over the couple of years that we've been on the air.
I think I've been in here more than once, probably twice so far, or 3 times, something like that.
Okay. Yeah, I'll go with that. I'll go with that. And like I said, it's just an honor to get to talk to you in any capacity, but to have you on the show is especially great because you always show up with amazing stuff and really compelling data. And I can't wait to delve into this with you. So yeah, welcome to the show. Anything you want to start out with saying to the listeners before I start peppering you with questions?
You know, I was telling my staff, I think this is just something that happened today. I thought I would share it with everyone. So, you know, we've just come off the greatest single year in apartment history and single family history, right? So all of those things, we've come off with the greatest single year. And there's a tendency that when you come off of this superstar, rock star year, there's a tendency to think, well, this year is going to have to be a downer to sort of adjust, right? To adjust to the fact that, you know, last year was like that, right? Because it really wasn't like this. It was zoop, yeah, right? Sure. And so there's this tendency to say, hey, this year is going to be that adjustment period. So I wanted to share something that happened earlier today with you guys. So as you know, Zillow is one of the 3 or 4 groups that forecasts single family home prices. And while we live in the multifamily industry, we know that single family home price increases are actually the biggest leading indicator of multifamilies. Mm-hmm. Because if you keep pricing lots of people out of the single family market, well, then they have to come live in apartments, right? So some people live in Class A apartments, that'll fill those up and that'll get pushed down to Bs, and those people get pushed down to Cs. That's how the trickle down effect works. And so it's critical that we follow single family prices. Now, last year was the greatest year ever for single family prices. They rose by about 18%. Some vendors say 17, some say 18. And so when I'm looking at that, I was like, what does this year look like? So Zillow had a forecast that came out about 4 or 5 weeks ago, Tate, and it was at 11%. So I was pretty happy with that because 11% after an 18% year is already room for, you know, it's something to celebrate.
Sure.
But this morning, Zillow sent an update, a public update saying, we would like to change our forecast because we were too conservative. We realized we looked at the data that's older. We're looking at new data. And because there is such a ridiculous amount of supply dislocation, disruption because of COVID, we're changing our 11% number to 16.
Wow.
What this means for everyone listening to this podcast that lives on the multifamily side of the fence is that we're going to have, if we get anywhere close to 16% on the single family side, we're going to have another incredible year of rent growth. Not in a year, but in a year and a half, because there's almost a 6 to 9 month lag between single family home prices going up and multifamily rents going up, because it takes a while for rents to renew, right? So you get this lag. So we basically now have an incredible 18 months if we get anywhere close to 16% annualized increases on the single family side. So I'm very excited because that really made my day.
Yeah. Totally. So how do you see that translating to rent growth, let's say?
So in my mind, I think this year was already set up for strong rent growth, regardless of what was happening to single family, you know, home prices. Why? Because of inflation, right? So the economy right now has true inflation, not just rent inflation, but true inflation of all types. It's somewhere in the 6% range. And what I went back and looked at, like rental increases during periods of high inflation, especially the 1980s, basically, rents always stayed ahead of inflation. So if inflation was at, you know, 12%, then rents were at 13 or 12, right? So they were never at 11, right? The rents didn't stay below inflation. They either stayed at inflation or mostly above inflation. So I think with inflation, likely it was 6% last year. Remember, this year, I think it's going to slow down. That's, you know, when the Fed increases interest rates, that pushes inflation down. So I think it's going to be somewhere in the 4%. So I'm betting rents are going to be, nationwide rents are going to come in at 6 or 7%. Last year was highest rent growth in history, and that was at 13% for the year, though many markets, like the market you're in, you know, the Utah markets did much better than that. The Phoenix market was at 29%. And so these are crazy numbers, because when we create, like when we created a 10-year pro forma for a project about 3 years ago, we forecast 30% rent growth in 10 years.
Right.
And two of our Phoenix projects hit 30% last year.
I keep hearing that story over and over again, where everybody's achieving their pro forma 5 years or 7 years or 4 years in the first year. Yep. And going ahead and either cashing out, recapitalizing, or and leveraging up or refinancing at that point.
Well, you should be hearing that story, right? So I just want to read off some of the accolades of last year, because not everyone here realizes just how outrageous last year was, right? So These are just some of what happened last year. Greatest annual price increase for single family home. Greatest annual price increase for multifamily homes. Greatest rent increases for both single family and multifamily. Great highest cap rate compression in a single year. Greatest per unit price increase in a single year, highest transaction volume for both single family and multifamily, the largest absorption rate in history for multifamily, highest occupancy rate of all time for multifamily, and finally, lowest cap rates in history for multifamily product in 12 markets. Yeah. That's last year.
Yeah, in the middle of a pandemic.
It was crazy. I mean, I thought last year was going to be good because of all the money injected. But when at the beginning of the year, I was basically saying, look, this is going to be like up and down. Every time COVID happens, you lose jobs, and, you know, it's going to go up and down. We were all wrong. Everyone in the industry was wrong. There was no down at any point in 2021. The rents only went in one direction. Prices only went in one direction. It was very smooth. Cap rates only declined very smoothly. Well, actually, they sort of crashed, but they cratered the whole year, which was great, right? We love crashing cap rates because that massively increases prices. So, yeah, I mean, just an absolutely unbelievable dream year. I can't imagine what more I could ask from God if I was asking for a perfect year.
Yeah. Maybe a little more inventory.
Well, then the inventory would reduce the prices.
So right. No. I know. Yeah, absolutely. That's the only thing I can think that I would ask God for at this point. Just deal flow. As many of the listeners know, and we've talked about it, there's such an abundance of liquidity right now. And
incredible. I've never seen liquidity like this ever. I think that, you know, I remember what happened with liquidity after, you know, 2009, 10, 11, when things started going back up and they started making things more liquid. It was nothing like this. I mean, the sort of liquidity we're seeing both on the lending and the equity side is at shockingly high levels, absolutely shockingly high levels, right? Mm-hmm. So Dr. Peter Linneman was on the Walker Dunlop podcast with about 2,000 people listening. That was about 2 weeks ago. So, you know, they ask him a tough question about cap rates, and they basically said, look, interest rates are going to go back up. You know what? We, at this point, we're pretty sure that there's going to be 4 hikes. He said, no, we think there's going to be 5 hikes. And they're like, why? Why do you think that there's 5 hikes in this year? He says, what you guys don't understand is the amount of liquidity in the market that's chasing product is absolutely crazy. And that liquidity itself is going to create inflation in the marketplace, because when so much money chases so little product, that's going to create all kinds of inflationary effects, and the Fed has to fight that. So he thinks that there's 5 hikes. So the next question obviously they had was, well, so if there's going to be 5 hikes, is that bad for real estate? He says, no, I am absolutely confident that at the end of this year, rents will be higher, property prices will be higher, and cap rates will be lower than they are today, right? And we're like, how can it get any lower, right? Mm-hmm. And he says, when you have such a massive amount of capital,
chasing assets, that capital gets more and more desperate. And he says, look, this isn't good news, because it starts to basically expand a bubble that's already being created in the multifamily market. It makes that bubble bigger, and the bigger the bubble, the harder it bursts. But he says, at this point, there's way too much money in the market, way too much liquidity. And the people that are buying, right, they're getting a gift. And so what's that gift? The gift is the way multifamily works. It takes 1 year for all the rent increases to show up in your net operating income. So for example, I'm going to give an example, right? So I said last year rent increases were, roughly 13% nationwide. Okay. Now imagine that 13% happened throughout the year. It didn't just happen in January. It didn't just happen in December. It happened throughout the year. So wouldn't you say that the leases that were renewed in October, right? Or maybe let's say June. The leases that are renewed in June, well, they only had half of that increase. The other half happened after that lease was renewed. Now, that lease is renewed this year in June. And so that second half bump is still there. Yeah. And so it can't possibly show up in net operating income. Mm-hmm. The institutional capital, these guys are math wizards. They absolutely know that those numbers are locked in. They know that and normally you might say, well, doesn't that happen all the time? Yes, but normally those rent increases are 2% in a year, not 13, right? So when you have 13% and half of that 13% is not yet factored into NOI, that's a big deal. That's usually 3 years worth of, factored in numbers that you're getting the benefit from if you're buying early in the year.
Yeah, yeah.
So amazing numbers are expected in Q1 and Q2, despite the fact that we now expect, I fully expect 4 to 5 interest rate hikes.
4 to 5, even though the Fed just in the last week said they weren't going to do an immediate raise, you're still expecting 4 to 5 this year?
Well, to me, I think the immediate raise is March, March. Okay. So I expect March, June, September, and December to be 4 raises. Mm-hmm. And it's possible that one of those 4 raises, the Fed can choose to do, 0.5% instead of 0.25. So they can choose to do a double raise on one of those 4s. I think it's pretty much guaranteed at this point that the Fed will raise.
Absolutely. So point and a half.
So, well, 0.25 each time. So that's basically by the end of the year, we end up with interest rates that are 1 point higher, maybe even 1.25 higher.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And obviously that trickles down, especially these days on the multifamily side, Tate, it trickles down much faster because everyone's using bridge loans. And bridge loans tend to adjust, and some of them are, more and more people are using floating bridge loans. They're tied to LIBOR, right? So essentially when LIBOR goes up, the rate goes up, right? And so I'm one of those people that has very strong belief that I shouldn't be locking in my bridge rate. So every time somebody gives me a much lower option that floats with LIBOR, I take it. And I am not regretting that one bit because I've now enjoyed over the last year, interest rates in the 2.5 to 2.6% range for my properties. Yeah. So when it does go up, right, on the other side, I've more than made my money up front.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, let's shift gears a bit because when everybody thinks of Neil Bawa, at least when I think of Neil Bawa and many of my friends and colleagues, we think market analyst expert, right? Like you've got this market analytics thing down, and it's so fun to talk to you about it because you know so much about all parts of the country, at least the lower 48. I've never heard you address Hawaii or Alaska before, but I've heard you address just about everything else, including Riverside, California, in your most recent webinar, which, by the way, everybody that's listening needs to go to Grow Capitus or Google Grow Capitus and also Multifamily U. And Grow Capitus is G-R-O with no W. So G-R-O-C-A-P-I-T-U-S. And check out the wealth of educational material that Neil and his team offers. It's unbelievable the amount of value add knowledge, specialized knowledge. If you're looking to expand your specialized knowledge base in this space, that is one of the best resources I think that there is out there. So thank you.
And most of our content is on multifamilyu.com. So that's what I think you should come in for, unless you're an investor, in which case go to Grow Capitus. You see the sign behind me. There you go. But most people I think can benefit more from multifamilyu.com. So you just go to multifamily followed by the letter u.com, go there, and you will see the Trends 2022 presentation that we just did. We had about
roughly 700 people attend, and then about 1,200 watched it as a video the next day. A lot of our people watch it as a video the next day. So about 2,000 people that attended it, and then I can share some of that content with you, Tate.
Yeah. And I attended and have since watched it a second time, and I sent it to my whole team and told them that it's very, very valuable to watch. So all of that said, let's just dive right in. So appreciation markets versus cash flow markets. And let's just start with Greenlight Equity Group, my company. We have picked Columbus, Ohio and Oklahoma City as our two target markets that we're immediately trying to make a massive impact in and really grow our portfolio inside of. So we picked those because we feel like, we know that we can make most of or a lot of the inventory, the deal inventory pencil inside of our model and our investors' expectations and what they're conditioned for. But we also feel like they're good growth markets, right? They're not hot primary type markets and never will be. But so let's just start with those two. If I could just be selfish and ask about our own markets and maybe use those as an example for what's kind of happening nationwide.
Absolutely. I think that these are good picks. So first, let me do Columbus, right? So there's a presentation that I do called Location Magic. It's also on the multifamilyu.com website. And I've been doing it for 7 years. And in all of those 7 years, the city that I've used for my examples has been Columbus, Ohio. So anyone that's watched Location Magic knows that I use it. And also most people that watch Location Magic will remember this comment. Columbus is the jewel of the Midwest or the jewel of the Rust Belt, however you prefer to call it. Because when I look at this city, it doesn't look like any other city in the Rust Belt. It doesn't look like Cleveland or Cincinnati or Pittsburgh. It doesn't look like Dayton, Ohio or St. Louis, Missouri. It doesn't look like any of them, right? Yeah. It actually is a city in the Rust Belt that looks like Southeast cities. It looks more like Tampa. It looks more like, Austin or San Antonio. Maybe not Austin because Austin's kind of crazy. So there's so many of these growth cities. Mm-hmm. That is in that Southeast belt. And Columbus looks like all of them in a dozen different ways that I can measure, with the exception of its actual location.
Yeah,
right? And so when I look at that, I go, wow, this is incredible. Because when people ask me, so is Columbus one of your top five cash flow cities? I say, no, Oklahoma City is in my top five list, right? Which I gave to people, last week. You heard me say in my top five cash flow cities, I'll put Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
But I didn't put Columbus in there because I think if you do that, you're kind of shooting yourself in the foot because you're saying this is a cash flow market. And to me, no, Columbus is one of the best examples of some cash flow and lots of appreciation. Some cash flow and lots of appreciation. Where if you go to like something like Austin, it's all appreciation, right? How do you get cash flow in Austin today, right? So I think it's a terrific example. Now, Oklahoma City is even a little more balanced. So there you're getting a significant amount of cash flow and a significant amount of appreciation, right? So when you look at different cities, one of the first things you should be really looking at is population growth. So the technical leaders of cash flow in the United States are not Oklahoma, are not Columbus. The technical leaders are Birmingham and Montgomery, both in Alabama, Buffalo in New York, Cleveland, then Pittsburgh and Dayton, Ohio. These are six that are considered cash flow leaders. Mm-hmm. The problem with all six, they're losing population. Now, Buffalo isn't losing population. The others are, but still, they're flat. But when you look at population gains in Oklahoma City or Columbus, they're very robust and very continuous, right? Mm-hmm. Obviously, Columbus is slightly on a higher scale than Oklahoma City is, but neither one of these cities is doing poorly for population growth. When you compare that to the price per door that you get in both of these cities compared to what you would get, let's say, in a really hot city like Nashville or in Tampa or anything in Texas, you're paying a lot less. And so there's a lot of value there with Oklahoma City. And you might say, why is it that you don't invest there? My answer is this. I have convinced my investors that I know where to get appreciation, and I've convinced them to live with that risk. Right. Mm-hmm. And I use very unusual strategies like super value add to basically go out to those markets and give, benefits to my investors. I don't expect anybody else to do super value add. As far as I know, I'm the only one in the US that doesn't. So just since I haven't defined this for your people, value add is the process simply of buying a property and then upgrading all the units and bumping rents. And usually you can bump them up $150 to $200 once you upgrade the units. Super value add is the process of buying properties where the property was zoned for more units than the property has today. So back in the 1980s, certain parts of the Southeast, you would have properties that are zoned for 250 units, but back then they wouldn't build 250 units simply because the market wasn't there at that point in time in the 80s, because those were not hot markets then. And so I go in, and before I buy the property, I talk to the city to see if I can actually build more units. I have a very Lego block product that I build there, and I just simply match the outdoor paint. The insides don't look anything like the rest of the property. The outside do, because I don't want it to look different. Mm-hmm. And so I go in there and I plop, like almost like SimCity, click, plop. I plop in 12 or 13 months a new building, right? I can only do it in certain cases. I can only do it in places that have plenty of parking and a significant amount of zoning. So for example, I've just finished plopping and selling a building that had 151 units, and it was in Georgia, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one of the hot states in the US. Yep. And I knew that that building was zoned for 237 units. So first to prove, I wanted to break it into two. So I plopped 29 units. Those 29 units created $31,000 a month in income, but only $2,000 a month in actual expenses. And most of that was property management. I didn't change anything. I didn't tweak anything else. $29,000 a month is $360,000 a year of NOI. Right. And at five cap, you know what that means, right? We made $7.5 million more on that property. So the investors exited at 50%. And then what I did was I did a very public sale. And then, you know, the price went up to $23.3 million. I bought it for 11, right? So obviously happy day. And I bought it, that top offer, I bought it back, because I know that that property actually is zoned for 237 units. And I'd already gotten the city to agree that I can build another 48 units in writing, right? So now I'm doing super value add two with the same exact property.
Wow.
And I 1031 all of my investors' money over. So essentially my investors kept the same building, ended up with double the amount of money, right? And are now basically going in for another journey. So that's called super value add. So I do those kinds of things. So I'm able to buy in expensive markets like Georgia, or I just build them from scratch. When you build something, you don't have to pay a four cap rate today. You know, right today, right now, anybody buying a value add is paying a four cap just about everywhere in the US. And we build a property to a 6.5 cap. Mm-hmm. When the property is done, mm-hmm. right? When you look at how much money you spend on it versus how much is coming in from rents, it's now a 6.5 cap property. Now, obviously, there's significant risk there for new construction, but I only bring my investors in when, you know, a lot of my zoning stuff is done. Like, for example, right now, there's a couple pieces of land that we haven't zoned yet. And so our deal with our investors is if we fail at zoning, we'll buy it back. We'll buy it back from the entity.
The entity, yeah.
And we'll provide another zoned property. Yeah. Right. Hasn't ever happened to us, but because we tend not to actually open a project until we've gotten to that point and beyond that point already. So 6 or 7 of the projects we're working on right now are already zoned. So bottom line is that works for us in expensive places. But to finish that thought, Tate, I think both of the cities that you guys are investing in are very strong cities.
Cool. Good to hear. We've known that, and I've been a Neil Bawa listener and learner for a long time. So I've heard you talk about Columbus in particular. Mm-hmm. I have to ask you about Cincinnati, because I think there's some uniqueness there, and that happens to be my hometown. I live in Salt Lake City, and I have for 21 years, but my whole family's still in Cincinnati, and it would make a lot of sense for us to move there next in terms of expanding. But does it sit there with Dayton and Cleveland
So I'm going to just simply rank this set for you, right? Columbus is up here. Oklahoma is one step below that because it doesn't appreciate as fast as Columbus. And then you've got Cincinnati, and then Cleveland and Dayton in my mind are a set of four. Why? The thing that I care about the most, the thing that I obsess about the most is what happens when things go wrong, right? Because when things go right, everything seems to go up at the same, you know, cadence, right? So Detroit goes up almost at the same cadence as Austin when it comes for single family prices, which makes no sense to me. But what happens when things go wrong? Anyone can look at, and this only takes you 5 seconds. So go to Google and type in, you know, population space Cincinnati and type in population space Cleveland. Now you'll notice that both cities took a hit in 2008, right? And then also in 2000. But you'll notice that Cincinnati's hit was so tiny that you almost couldn't see it. Cincinnati is a city where people don't leave when things go wrong. They like it. They love it. They stay there. And the population is pretty steady, Eddie. The problem with Cleveland and Dayton, Ohio as well is the moment something goes wrong, both of these cities have a sharp loss of population. And that sharp loss of population kills rents by 20%+. I've never seen that happen to Cincinnati through a bunch of recessions. So to me, it's a superior city compared to Cleveland or Dayton.
Cool. Good. Well noted. And I can't wait to talk to my partners about that one. And then Indianapolis, this will be the last specific one I ask you about, but Indianapolis, I've heard you mention before. I think there's some pretty exciting dynamics to Indianapolis. What are your thoughts on that, on Indy?
Absolutely. To me, Indy is just like Cleveland, just like Columbus. It gives you cash flow. It gives you appreciation. It has substantial population growth. It has a substantial number of businesses moving in. It's strategically located. There's just a lot of good stuff happening in Indianapolis. We give awards to one city a year, and then we also have this Dark Horse Award. And Indy has been in the running for Dark Horse 3 years. And last year, we finally gave it a well-deserved Dark Horse Award. It didn't win this year. It's very rare for a city to win Dark Horse 2 years in a row. Uh-huh. But the fact that out of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cities that we look at, this wins Dark Horse, I think Indianapolis is in a very good place. I think that there's a possibility that some point in the next 10 years, it would actually win City of the Year in our, you know, presentation that we do in January. I think there's a possibility that it could win in the future because I see it going in the right direction. So I think Indy is a terrific city to invest in. My only feedback for Indy is this. There's some areas that are just too high in crime. What you shouldn't be greedy about is you're already getting one hell of a deal when you go into Indy from a perspective of rents and cap rates. You know, it cash flows quite well compared to all of these superstars that I just mentioned. Don't be extra greedy and go into a high crime part of Indy.
Yeah.
Okay. Go to a good part of Indy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. Class B maybe. Or
yeah. That's where Class B makes sense today, right? That's where Class B makes sense today. You know, you can't really do Class B at a reasonable price in, you know, Texas or Florida, yeah, or, you know, North Carolina, but you can still do it in Indy. So just go for that.
Right, right. Well, so Texas, Florida, I mean, Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, mm-hmm, those are obviously where the big, big stuff is happening. It also happens to be...
And North Carolina. Don't forget North Carolina.
Absolutely. Yeah, North Carolina for sure. It also happens to be most of those markets, most of the metro markets in those areas are pretty dang compressed as far as cap rates go. And that's why, you know, we don't really have deal flow coming in from any of those markets for us because we're in an expansive phase of our business where we need to add to our balance sheet as much equity as possible. And while we, you know, and we're based in Utah, so it would, you know, obviously geographically make sense to invest in Utah, but it doesn't make sense for us in our model to, because no, it just stuff's just too dang expensive. And you've only got the value add play in those markets.
Yep.
Which is speculative, right? Like you don't know. Things could go south and then you're not paying for the building because you bought it for too much.
That makes sense. Yeah. That makes sense. I think that there's still money in smaller cities in Utah. So I would definitely consider investing. This is the trend. I see institutional players stepping down where they would used to invest in gateway markets like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, the San Francisco Bay Area, and Miami. And then they started stepping down. And so in the last year, year and a half, we've seen them invest in Phoenix and Austin and, you know, Raleigh, North Carolina. That's really where their money's been going. And now today in 2022, their money is actually going to tertiary metros. They're investing in places like Tucson. They're investing in places like Knoxville, Tennessee, instead of investing in Nashville, Tennessee. So they're going down a step. They're investing in Greenville, South Carolina. And so as the institutional money goes to these markets, they're also beginning to compress. So I would say there's still smaller markets that I'm looking at in Utah, St. George. I don't look in Salt Lake City. I don't look in Provo. I think that train has passed. But I look in Logan. And you might say, Logan's not even a city. It's a town. Yes, but it's a very profitable town. Yeah. It has the lowest unemployment rate of any city in America.
So I look at those kinds of numbers, right? I'm not looking to buy a 300 unit property in Logan, but I wouldn't mind, you know, taking a 150 on. And you might say, Neil, at this stage in your career, why are you buying 150? Shouldn't you be buying 300, 400s? The answer is I would if they were available at a reasonable price.
Mm-hmm.
I'd much rather say, well, it's just more work for my asset management team, and I'll take a 150 in Logan, right? Or I'll build 100 units in Logan. Remember, building 100 units is the same as, you know, owning 160 or 170 units, kind of a same dollar numbers that are involved, same amount of work and same money. So I'll much rather take that. We just lost a bid in Logan that was a 106 units, and three people, you know, came in ahead of us. So people know that these are great markets to invest in. But that's, again, that's Utah. There's definitely other places to look at as well. I also recommend tertiary metros in Florida at this point, right? So you've got, you know, Cape Coral, Punta Gorda, Fort Myers. I mean, there's just so much happening at this point of time in Florida. It is astonishing. I tell people each year, you know, I talk about the states that are really blockbusters. Last year, I talked about Utah and Idaho together being two states that were going up together like crazy. And we've seen that incredible increase in places like Boise and also Salt Lake. This year, it's Florida, 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 Florida. I see incredible, incredible increases in Floridian markets, mostly in tertiaries, but also in major markets, you know, Orlando, Jacksonville, Miami, and also Miami metro cities, like places that are 20 or 30 miles from Miami. Absolutely astonishing numbers. And the best of them all at this point in time, I think, is Tampa.
Tampa, yeah. Surrounding, in the surrounding markets around Tampa, yep. Yeah.
St. Petersburg, you know, going all the way down to Sarasota, those markets are pretty strong.
What's the play in those markets, Neil? Is it a, well, let's say for you, is it a new build play, or what are you looking for there?
I speak as a demographer. I currently have no offers, and I haven't had any offers in Florida for the last 6 to 9 months. And people, you know, you might say, hey, you're just talking about this stuff. The answer is, look, I am in 10 different states. I've got a big portfolio. I've got $900 million in play. You can't just always use, you know, I'm known to be the most promiscuous developer in the sense that I move every year from metro to metro and follow the numbers, right? So nobody else has, that I know off in our markets, in our circles, actually has assets in 10, you know, states. I do, but each additional state becomes harder and harder. So we haven't gone into Florida. So we have nothing to pump, nothing to dump. We're just saying, look, the data is pointing to Florida. We're busy with Texas, which is a close second at this point in time, but it's not quite there in terms of how hot Texas is likely to be this year. I do think that the part of Texas that we're investing in, Central Texas, which is basically the corridor between San Antonio and Austin, is as hot as Florida, but even that is not going to be hotter than Florida.
Yeah, I love that San Antonio and North area. I think that's just a fantastic place to be. That's awesome. Amazing. So let's shift gears a little bit and talk. Well, we talked about cash flow plays, appreciation plays. I don't want to spend too much time on those, but what's worth paying attention to, I guess, trend-wise in the appreciation markets?
It's Austin. So I think, keep in mind, last year, Austin crushed everything else in the US in terms of home price increases, 44%, right? Nothing came close. Now, Phoenix beat Austin handily when it came to rent increases. But remember, it takes 12 months for home prices to go up and then rents to go up. So I think Austin's going to have incredible rent increases this year. Mm. And I think Austin is a unicorn in the real estate world because it is the new Silicon Valley. $17 billion just from Samsung. Tesla just built a factory that's over a mile long and has now applied in the last week to add, you know, about another 6,000 or 7,000 people there. A blockbuster new campus from Apple, a massive new campus from Google. It's just the list of companies moving to Austin is incredible. I believe that, and I live in Silicon Valley. I believe that this is the new Silicon Valley. If I look at prices in Silicon Valley for every asset here, every asset, and I look at what Austin has, it's still cheap. It's still cheap.
Awesome. So all about Austin, are there any other sleepers that I could get out of you at this point that we haven't mentioned?
Let me think. So let me think about, you know, some of the others that I think are going to do well. So
San Antonio, I think, is basically enjoys the Austin halo. It's 70 miles away. So that's something for you to look at. What else? Knoxville, Tennessee is one that I like. Nashville prices have gone completely insane. And I think Knoxville will benefit. I look for halo cities. I often, very rarely will I invest in the metro that's doing the best. For example, I love Phoenix. I've really enjoyed the stratospheric growth. You know, rents went up 29% last year. But I don't have any assets in Phoenix. I have one 30 miles this way and one 30 miles that way, right? Mm-hmm. So when you're looking at markets, basically look at those sorts of things. I think that, you know, Killeen, for example, is the other. You know, if you go down 70 miles, you're in San Antonio. If you go up 60 or 70 miles, you're in Killeen. And actually, people can live in Killeen and work in North Austin, which is the richest part of Austin. So that's a market to look at. I think Greenville, South Carolina is a market that's not in people's radars. I think that's a terrific market. It will continue to do well. I only have one small asset there. I'm not very vested in this marketplace. But when I look at the health of markets, when I look at their positioning, when I look at where they're located, I don't see how Greenville, South Carolina loses. And in North Carolina, I don't think, you know, Raleigh, Charlotte, really expensive markets, but take a look at Asheville. I think that's a beautiful city, great quality of living. I think Asheville would do really well. And so with Winston-Salem, I think North Carolina as a state is very hot. You're not going to make, you know, a lot of money today in Charlotte or Raleigh, but you certainly can in Asheville or Winston-Salem.
Asheville is a gorgeous place. Been there. And yeah, it's as mountainous as it gets really in the East, in that part of the world.
That's usually good for real estate because you're locked in, right? So when you've got mountains, you really can't expand, right? I often will buy, for example, the Georgia property that I was mentioning. That property, they haven't done any new constructions because the whole city is on hills. There's really no land left that's flat. Now you have to basically cut down a hill, then that's usually too expensive to build.
What just popped into my head? I said I wouldn't ask you about it anymore. How about Traverse City, Michigan? Do you ever hear anything about that area of the world?
That hasn't really come up in my list. So I think that the only cities that we profiled in Michigan have been Lansing and Ann Arbor. So that city that you mentioned is too small, has not come up in our number. Sometimes small cities will pop up, like Logan, Utah pops up like way too often in our numbers. So it shows almost always at the top, sort of St. George. So you live in a state that actually has two really pretty small cities that pop up in our numbers. The city you mentioned hasn't come up.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean that it's a bad city, by the way. It just means that if it's not in the top 10 or 15% in the US, I probably won't profile it.
Sure. Sure. And one last one, you mentioned in your webinar, the 2022 real estate trends. Listeners, go find that on Multifamily U. But you mentioned Ogden, Utah. That's an hour from where I live. And I love Ogden. I love the situation that it's in as far as the geographics around it. The economy, it's right in the path of progress. It's like the last city.
It's the last city left. It's the last city left that has some appreciation. Well, I shouldn't say appreciation. It's the last city that left that has some organic appreciation, you know, not cap rate related, but has some organic capability for rents to grow just from salary growths. So that's the last. And, you know, but one of the things is if you talk to people in Utah, a lot of them don't have a good opinion of Ogden. Used to be pretty, you know, sketchy maybe 15 years ago. But I encourage you to go there now. I think if you haven't actually spent significant amounts of time in the Ogden of today, not the Ogden of 5 years ago or 10 years ago, then you don't truly know the Ogden, right? So you know, another city that I had a negative impression of until I actually spent some time researching it was Waco, Texas. Oh. So, you know, Waco back 10 years ago, used to be the armpit of Texas. Well, when I study its numbers today, it doesn't seem like the armpit of anything. Right. So over time, your opinions, the data changes your opinions. And I think Ogden is very different from the way it used to be a while back. So I think this is definitely a good city. Once again, be careful of crime. There's one part of Ogden that still has pretty high crime, but the rest of it is definitely a great place to invest. You'll still have the problem with you Utahns, Tate, is you never sell property. You just buy it and then you keep it forever. That's the problem, right? Yeah. And it goes up and up. I mean, Utahns had gained a tremendous amount of money because other people sold their assets in 15, 16, 17, 18. You guys held on to all of yours. So now you're double rich, right? Yeah. And so it's remarkable to see how much, you know, real estate wealth has gone to Utah.
You still think that Salt Lake City has a lot of upside?
I think so. I think so. Because keep in mind the positioning, when a positioning of a city changes. So, you know, cities, they'll go from here to here and then eventually they'll stop. Except sometimes a city changes its positioning. Mm-hmm. When that city changes its positioning, its entire, you know, capability moves up. Salt Lake is actually changing its positioning with regards to US cities. As it gets positioned, then it moves into a different class of cap rates. Yeah. And a different, so that's what's happening. You know, it's a transitioning city. Cities that have changed positioning have been Denver, Nashville, Salt Lake, are all cities. Phoenix itself is a city that's changed positioning, right? Mm-hmm. Austin has seen a radical change. I mean, 10, 15 years ago, Austin was the cheapest part of Texas. So it's seen a very, very radical technology-driven change. So there's probably a dozen cities in the US that are actually doing positioning changes, and right there, Salt Lake's one of them.
Yeah, yeah. So as far as trends go, talk to me about build to rent. What are your thoughts on build to rent? And is that really the best play in a lot of these markets right now? If you're Neil Bawa and your team, are those the kind of plays that you're going after?
So I like the way you asked me the question, but I'm not going to answer it that way because I think that's a cop out. I think that build to rent is the best play for certain groups of people. It's not always the right play for everyone else. So in my case, I have a large organization with, you know, development directors and managers that do development. And then I've got, you know, owners reps that basically go out to the site. When you've got that kind of an installation and you've got a large database of fans that understand the value of built to rent, it's an incredible marketplace. So maybe I'll answer the question a different way. So if Tate comes to me and says, you have three choices today. And your choices are, you'll buy three value add buildings in three of your favorite metros, or you'll build three apartment complexes from scratch in three of your favorite metros, or you'll build three build to rent projects in your three favorite metros, right? Most people would think Neil's probably going to do one of each. It's like, I'll do a value add, I'll do this, I'll do that. My answer is no, I follow the numbers. Build to rent is wildly more profitable than either building apartments or doing value add for the right kind of people that have both the database. Remember, it's 3 to 5 times harder to raise money for new construction than it is no cash flow than it is for value add. So you may not have the right database. So I'll just pick the three BTRs because my math shows I can't lose, but there's a very high chance that I'm going to win very, very big, right? Mm-hmm. So I'll give you some numbers that I think will shock you. So Central Texas and Phoenix are the homes of built to rent. And built to rent essentially is a fancy word for single family homes designed in a large community for rentals. And they're small. Usually there's 1,000 square feet, 1,100 square feet, pretty small. But they're single family homes, postage stamp size backyard, postage stamp size front yard. Or the one that's becoming more popular now is townhomes. So, you know, you can either have stacked townhomes, two levels, maybe, you know, four in a building. You don't want to have 10 in a building because then, you know, once again, you got to have that single family feel. So two together, four together is very common in the built to rent space. When you look at those products and you look at how long people live in them and how much of a rent increase they sustain, in rent increases that they can sustain over time, easily beats multifamily. In terms of how long they live, usually twice as long. So you've got your churn going down and the ability to raise rents without having to kick a tenant out or force them out is substantially higher. People like us who've done this, who have, you know, large portfolios, we know that the magic is all in the churn and in the rent increases. That's where you make money or not make money. Right. Those two things, BTR, built to rent product, just crushes multifamily. It's not even close, right? Somewhere around 40 to 50% higher in terms of net NOI per unit. That's incredible. I'll take half of that number. It's that much higher. So when I look at BTR product, I'm saying it's kind of hard to lose. If I screw it up, I'll make some money. If I don't screw it up, I'll make crazy amounts of money. So cap rates for BTR product in Central Texas have now dropped to 2.5 cap. 2.5 cap, yeah. Right? I can't build anything that's an apartment in any market in the US for lower than 4 cap.
Right.
But the same exact product, if it's built to rent, is 2.5 cap. These are actual sales, by the way. I'm not making these numbers up. These are sales that have happened in the last 3 or 4 months.
institutional capital coming in and
usually institutional. Yes, exactly. There's $76 billion of built to rent capital that was raised from April 2020 to February 2022. So less than 2 years, $76 billion unleveraged. So if you leverage that, that's $304 billion of assets. The total construction pipeline in the US appears to be less than 5% of that.
Wow.
And that is causing insane cap rate compression. So when cap rates compress like that, it's like, there's nothing else that compares to this. I'm just going to stick with it. So I love value adds. And it's not like I stopped buying value adds, Tate. Mm-hmm. I have closed on two value adds in January, right? This just in Jan, I bought two properties. So in my database, you'll see emails, you know, about us thumping our chest about them. But that's not the core of our business anymore. And unless I see those 2.5 caps go back to 3.5, I'm just pushing as hard as I can on the built to rent side. All I can say is for most people, it's dangerous because new construction requires an astonishing skill set compared to value add. Mm-hmm. But be aware that this is not something that Neil Bauer is saying, because Neil Bauer doesn't have $76 billion. Neil Bauer doesn't have $1 billion, right? $76 billion was raised for built to rent. So other people absolutely and 100% agree with me when it comes to built to rent. And it's going to start impacting multifamily in about 2 years, because in 2 years, the initial set of BTR product will deliver and start to compete with Class A, push down Class A prices, which will push down Class B, which will push down Class C. So there's going to be an impact.
Interesting. That's not an impact I would have anticipated. It makes sense, but you just don't ever hear about downward force on rents these days.
It's not really downward force. Maybe Class A rents would have gone up by 7% and now they're going to go up by 2%.
Sure.
So then that pushes down the Class B growth, right? Okay. So downward is maybe not the right word, but it can significantly impact the growth that you were going to experience if that BTR product hadn't come into the marketplace. That BTR product also is much better looking. I mean, people don't want to live in apartments for more than a few years. BTR, they're like, this is my home. I'm going to just live here forever. That mindset is I've never seen with apartments.
Yeah, you can see why. Like, people get their own home, their own yard, their own backyard, their own garage usually, and they're nice places, nice communities. On your projects, what's like an average unit count on size on these projects?
So I like to build more properties rather than like build blockbuster 300, 400 units. So the largest project that we are currently engaged in is 266 units, and that was a very weird one-off. But a lot of them are 150 to 200 units. Institutional grade investors like to buy at 150. Mm-hmm. So especially newer product, they'll buy 150 all day long. So that 150 to 200 is kind of our sweet spot at this point. For we raised $70 million from our investors on November 18th. So we only did one webinar basically to raise that money. And that was 8 projects. I think the average is about 180 units. For those 8.
By the way, listeners, he just said he raised $70 million in one day, right? Neil, did I hear that right?
One day of presentation takes 45 days for the money to come in.
Sure. That's amazing. Amazing. Yeah, just amazing. Okay, so the build to rent product, other trends in the multifamily space that you see that are important to take note of as we go into the kind of the heart of 2022 here?
Well, I think the big one is remote work, right? So anyone who thinks that remote work was a COVID only thing is delusional, right? Let me break it down for you. There was this survey by Gallup of employees. 60% of them prefer to work remotely as much as possible in a post COVID world, right? Other surveys show 83%. So, you know, fine, employees want to work, remote work after COVID, but what about companies, right? Reuters did a survey of 1,200 C-level executives that said as many as 34% of employees would work remotely in 2021 last year. So that number came in about right. And possibly 10 to 15% for all time in the future, right? So what does that 10 to 15% mean? It doesn't sound like a big number. It's a game changer for real estate because these white collar workers, these office workers, they're more in demand than blue collar workers. And because COVID has accelerated retirements in the 55 plus category, these white collar workers, they're projected to have incredible bargaining power with employers in the next 5 years, much more so than they did before COVID. Now, this new bargaining power means that we should now have
That's the number. 12 to 22 million white collar workers that can live anywhere in the US, work from anywhere in the US. And what's funny is, Tate, most people think that these moves actually happened during the pandemic. We're done with that. Yeah, more Americans moved in the pandemic than ever before, but those were short-term moves. They moved to be with family. They moved away from dense cities. But eventually, over the last year and a half, a lot of those people moved back. Now, Tate, they're researching, they're planning, they're talking to family about the permanent move. And we estimate that over 10 million are going to move permanently in 2022, 2023. And those are gigantic numbers. And where are they going? I mean, they're going to Florida, Texas, Arizona, Las Vegas, Nevada, North Carolina, Georgia, Tennessee, Utah, Idaho, right? Idaho, in terms of percentage, is getting the largest increases in population. And Utah's right after that, number two. So Idaho, Utah in percentages. In terms of raw numbers, as you can imagine, big states are Florida and Texas. So those are the two big states winning in terms of numbers. And Idaho and Utah are winning in terms of percentages. Those are huge numbers. Mm-hmm. Something has changed. It's massive. It's incredible. And it's changing cap rates, right? So you've gone from Boston, Los Angeles, New York being the top three markets in the US for cap rates to now the top four markets in the US are Austin, San Antonio, Phoenix, and Dallas.
Yeah.
And all of that happened in the last 12 months. So we're still at the beginning of this.
And New York City is around 10 now, right?
It's 10th, and I think it's going to drop out of the top 10 list by next year because it's still declining. Cap rates there are not declining, which means the prices are basically stable in New York City. And everywhere else, cap rates are declining, so it's going to fall out of the list.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Imagine that the Big Apple's not in the top 10 in the U.S., yeah, right? This is a different world.
Yeah, sure is. Sure is. Do you see that changing with New York? Just is its own beast and so resilient. In so many ways.
It's incredibly resilient. There's nothing wrong with the New York market, right? I mean, it's still a low cap rate market. People love living in New York. The problem is it the best market? Is it the market that will compress the most? Is it the market that's going to see the most population growth? Is it going to see the most growth in terms of technology? No, the answer to all of those questions is no. And none of that makes New York any less awesome.
Yeah.
It's just from an investment perspective, people who are investing in New York today, I just scratch my head and go, why?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. There's a number of places you mentioned on that shorthand list of yours with those historically low cap rates. Bay Area, you know, another one. Like, yep. Those are head scratchers for sure. It's tough to make.
Bay Area was the only market in the US that saw a increase in cap rates in the last 12 months. So every market in the United States saw decreasing cap rates, which means increasing prices. There was one single market in the US, not even Detroit, Michigan, saw a flat cap rates, but the Bay Area actually saw increases because their rents were falling for most of the year before they sort of started to go up again. And so I don't invest in the San Francisco Bay Area, but I love where I live. I think the San Francisco Bay Area is the best place in America to live in. And so I feel a little sad that we're going to become an also-ran if our government doesn't turn things around. So I think California has got the most crazy government in the US. I can't think of one other government that's as loony as our government. And I really hope that they can turn it around.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And by the way, California hasn't lost population ever, right? But in 2020, California lost population. And what's even scary is most of the population loss, you would think it was Los Angeles or Sacramento. No, there was really no population loss anywhere except the San Francisco Bay Area, which is the beating heart of California, which is where all of their tax revenue comes from. Mm. People are leaving, yeah. Right? So yeah. if that doesn't send alarm bells ringing in Sacramento, I don't know what will.
Yeah, yeah. And that's real. Like I have friends that have moved from the Bay Area to Utah and they love the lifestyle and the low cost of living. They can't believe what $700,000 will get them in a house. And
from my street, somebody has moved to Utah from my street. Right. Mm-hmm. So I feel it very personally that like these are people that we loved and they lived here for 10 years. Now they're like, look, I'm going to sell this home for $2.1 million. I'm going to buy a much nicer, bigger home in Utah for $700,000 and $1.4 million. You know, they happen to have five kids. It's like, we're going to put five kids through college and still have $1 million left over.
Yeah.
How can you even argue about that?
Right.
Right. It's just like, okay, well, good for you.
Yeah. Yeah. It is sad though, in a lot of ways, but
Well, Neil, this has been amazing. Unfortunately, we're kind of run up against time here. Just fascinating conversation, fascinating information, as always, from you. Are there any last takeaways that, I mean, you've dropped so many wonderful things on us to take away from this, but any last words of wisdom to our listeners here?
Well, I think I'd like to just go with a, you know, a phrase. I think you've heard it from me before, but maybe not on this podcast. And it says, the Bible got it wrong by one letter. It is not the meek that shall inherit the earth. It's the geek. We're going to inherit the earth. We're already inheriting the earth. Richest man in the world, geek. Second richest, geek. Third richest, geek. Are you seeing a pattern, Tate? Are you seeing a pattern?
Yes, I am. I'm seeing that pattern. I like it. That's a good one. I'll take that one. And that's going to be the title of the show.
Sounds good.
Geek shall inherit the earth. Well, sir, thank you again so much for being here with us and for taking this time and sharing all of the wisdom that you have. It's just a fascinating space to get to share with you whenever I get to talk to you. And I'm looking forward to your presenting at the Best Ever Conference here at the end of the month, I believe, aren't you?
They invited me, and I may or may not go. I'm still talking with Ben Lapidus, who is the CEO of the conference, and he and I are texting back and forth, so we'll see what happens.
Well, I hope you make it. I'm planning on being there, and I hope you make it. And listeners, this is the beginning of February 2022. We're talking about a conference, the best ever conference at the end of the month here. So
in Denver.
Yeah, in Denver. So this episode will probably be out before that. So. And Neil, if listeners want to get in touch with you and learn more about all of the wonderful stuff that you have to offer, what's the best way for them to do that?
I have a very unique name, N-E-A-L and space B-A-W-A. Just hit enter in Google. I think the first 500 articles are all about me. So good, bad, ugly. If there's anybody bitching about, you know, a Neil Bawa, they're probably bitching about me. Good things probably about me too. So check it out.
Yeah. And Multifamily U. For those of you that want to learn more and see all the webinars that are available. It's just a wealth of resource. So Neil, thank you again so much. Really appreciate you.
Thanks so much for having me on the show.
You bet. You bet. Listeners, thank you for listening to another episode of The Apartment Guys. I encourage you to reach out to Neil, to me, use these resources that you've taken notes down on, hopefully, or mental notes. And get out there and get busy and grow your business and let us know how we can help in the meantime. So with that, listeners, I'll bid you a good week and go get them. Take care, everybody.
This episode of The Apartment Guys is being brought to you by Greenlight Equity Group. Greenlight Equity Group acquires and operates cash-flowing multifamily assets in progressive metropolitan markets such as Salt Lake City, Idaho, San Antonio, Oklahoma City, and Columbus, Ohio. Greenlight targets consistent solid returns for its investors and a healthy environment for residents by operating high quality, safe, clean, affordable apartment communities. To learn more about Greenlight and to sign up for the investor list, go to www.glequitygroup.com.
Thanks for listening to The Apartment Guys with Tate Seymour. Tate and friends are grateful to have you as a loyal listener. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe, rate, review, and share with friends on your Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or any other podcast platform. Also, check out Tate's YouTube channel for videos of many of these episodes and more. Until next time, take massive action steps and rock on.